Hi, everybody, and welcome into Rethink Reshoring. I'm Kaylee Nix. This is a brand new show here at FreightWaves. We're taking a look at the world of reshoring, the changing policies of global trade, what this looks like for us here back home on American soil. Super excited to bring this to you. Of course, we are here with the executive director of the Reshoring Institute, Rosemary Coates, is joining us. Absolute top-notch, best firsthand perspective to talk about reshoring. Rosemary, thank you so much for joining us and for the idea to really create this show and get into a topic that I think people maybe recognize when they hear the word reshoring, but maybe they don't know a whole lot about.
Yes, thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it. I think this is going to be a lot of fun over the next few weeks with the series on reshoring and all the various aspects of it.
So getting right into things, reshoring is a concept that's not necessarily new when it comes to how we talk about supply chain, but it has really picked up in popularity specifically through the last kind of 3 years. Give us a broad overview about what reshoring is and specifically how it sits with the United States at the center when our conversation around reshoring.
Yeah, well, you know, reshoring, the term has been around for a while, at least 10 years. I think the start of the reshoring movement was in about 2012 during the presidential election when Barack Obama and Mitt Romney were both China bashing like crazy and starting to talk about the potential to bring some manufacturing back. And actually, a lot of my clients started asking about whether or not it was economically feasible to bring manufacturing back. And I think, you know, we started kind of slowly evaluating that and started gaining some more sophistication in making decisions regarding where in the world to manufacture. And it was building over time. And then the pandemic hit. And when that happened, risk was introduced into supply chain like we'd never seen before. So having to deal with another variable, the size of the kind of risks that we were experiencing where Chinese factories were opening and closing and opening and closing, you know, introduced a whole new aspect to that decision-making policy. And I think an awful lot of companies, certainly our clients, are now considering their global manufacturing strategy. So we call it reshoring, but in a lot of cases, it's their overall global manufacturing strategy. And that means where in the world should they manufacture or have multiple plants? Do they have a China plus one strategy, a China plus two countries? Are they bringing everything back to the U.S.? Are they expanding factories here? Are they sourcing here? There's a lot of moving parts and components to that decision.
So just like everything in supply chain, reshoring is something that is very much complicated, right? As you mentioned, lots of moving parts. And it very much differs on your perspective on if you are looking at someone who uses globalization as part of their supply chain, if someone who is more regionally focused, or if someone who tends to stay closer to home and tends to like things a little bit more local. Since we are speaking from the perspective of America, give us just kind of a broad overview on what the general landscape of reshoring tendencies looks like in America right now. Obviously, COVID was that kind of catalyst that caused a lot of folks to really rethink their supply chain and then thus rethink their reshoring initiatives, hence the name of our show.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, for many years, and I was right in the thick of things. So for many years, we were offshoring to China. And it was essentially what my clients wanted to do. I'd go talk to clients, and I'm a management consultant, and I'd talk to my clients, and they would say, get me to China. I know I need to be there. My competitors are there. It's cheaper, you know, and on and on and on. And that was, you know, started in the late 90s, but then really took off after 2001 when China ascended to the World Trade Organization. And the door sort of flew open and it became a great market for manufacturing as well as selling into that market. So companies had a strategy of just moving there just because it was cheaper. Fast forward to today, China is no longer a low-cost country. In fact, at the Reshoring Institute, we produced a report just before Christmas, and we compared labor rates in 12 countries in about 10 job categories. And if you have a look at the study results, you'll see that China is right smack in the middle of those 12 countries. at the low end now is Vietnam, India, and central Mexico, and not at the border so much, but central Mexico. And so if you have a supply chain that includes manufacturing with a lot of labor content, then you would be looking for a low-cost labor country like India or Bangladesh or Costa Rica or central Mexico. But if you have the ability to automate your production, then that's a completely different kind of decision-making process. And you have, if you can automate and extract that labor, you have an opportunity for a lot of different places to manufacture your product. And hopefully that includes the U.S. The results in the environment and the business environment in the U.S. because of this kind of thought process and strategic decision making is pretty profound. So what we're seeing now is a lot of our clients who have decided to source more raw materials in the U.S., which is sort of the first step in reshoring. So you would try to redevelop some of your supply base here and then eventually bring manufacturing back here. So from ThomasNet, they are a sort of directory of suppliers across the U.S. I don't know if any of the audience are old enough to remember the old Thomas registers. They were big sort of yellow pages for manufacturers that we used to look up manufacturers. We were looking for nuts and bolts. You looked up nuts and bolts or fasteners and you found people there. Well, now all of that is online, but Thomas still is that go-to company where buyers look for manufacturers. And they did a study recently within the last year or two and found that most industrial buyers are now actively trying to find more raw material suppliers and parts suppliers in the U.S. And if each of those industrial buyers, they surveyed about, I don't know, 1,000 or so industrial companies. If they were each to choose 10 or 11 new suppliers in the U.S., and bring some of that that sourcing back to the U.S., it translates into $443 billion injected into the U.S. economy, which is just astonishing. I mean, it's a huge amount of money that can be pushed into the U.S. economy. And of course, when that happens, it has a magnifier effect. So when we start manufacturing in the U.S., we have more need for transportation. We need more trucks to move that equipment around. We need more warehousing. We need more fast fulfillment. We are better off in terms of sustainability because we're shortening those long global supply chains. So it's very positive all around. The other thing that we know is that when every dollar that's spent on new manufacturing in the U.S., every dollar that's spent for wages in manufacturing has about a 1.4 magnifier effect on the local economy. So people who work in manufacturing, earn a wage in manufacturing, which is roughly, say, $65,000 to $85,000 a year is an average manufacturing salary. And that is squarely middle class for most of America. And those people, when they earn a salary, they spend their money locally. Mm-hmm. So they shop locally, they eat out at restaurants, they have their hair done, they buy cars, they buy houses, they buy big screen TVs, they send their kids to college. And so that magnifier effect is very profound on the economy. It's very important, very positive. And we should, I think, all support that in order to rebuild our economy and to strengthen our economy in the U.S. That was a long-winded one.
Manufacturing is kind of that, like almost the lifeblood of that stereotypical American dream thought process, right? And we really saw that came to fruition after the end of World War II. And after we historically started to move into this kind of middle class, you do see that median earning potential that's really kind of when this all started to take shape. Of course, the way that global geopolitical events kind of influenced things through the end of the 1900s and into the start of the 2000s, plus where we are now, there's so much ground to cover when it comes to talking about reshoring. So many topics, which is why we have this show, right? To dig into a little bit of each of those. So I'm sure that throughout these upcoming weeks, we'll talk a little bit about history. We'll talk a little bit about events. We'll talk a little bit about kind of that trickle down theory that you mentioned. But I heard you talk about the Reshoring Institute, which is, of course, where you are from, executive director and the chairwoman of their board. Talk to us a little bit about the Reshoring Institute, what it does as a nonprofit. It's not quite a consulting group, but it is there for industry perspective and industry insight.
Right. Well, so I had spent 25 years helping companies with global manufacturing, offshoring to China and, you know, closing down factories in the U.S. And, you know, it was got pretty bleak. It was pretty awful. And so after the 2012 election that I mentioned, you know, I thought it was really important to rethink how we were talking to our clients and how we were giving them advice and leading them. And so we developed a methodology for evaluating the potential for reshoring. And that ultimately became the Reshoring Institute, which was housed at the University of San Diego for the first 3 years. I'm on the board at the University Supply Chain Management Institute. And so I asked them if they would house the Reshoring Institute. They were all over it. So we were housed there. We took interns only from USD for the first 3 years. And then we went nationwide. And today we have affiliations with 14 universities. And we're about to take on two more. So it's very exciting. We take paid interns, mostly from graduate school, MBA students and masters in engineering. And we teach them about manufacturing. And then they help us with our projects and our case studies and our white papers and so forth. And yes, and it's true, we also provide services. So we do small consulting projects and we're a nonprofit. So they're very inexpensive by comparison to what you would find in the big consulting world. And I know this because that's where I came from. So we have inexpensive projects. We do things like site selection. So we help companies find a new manufacturing site. We do a lot of trade compliance work. I happen to be a licensed customs broker, so I get a lot of the import work. So we develop that. We do domestic sourcing work. So we do lots of engagements where we'll help clients find domestic sources, you know, which is kind of interesting because during the period when we were offshoring everything, especially to China, all the suppliers went there too. So today, if you're looking for that product that you sourced 20 years ago in the U.S., there's nobody making it anymore. And so a lot of cases, you have to develop a new source. So we do that kind of research, find companies that potentially could make a product and so forth. We do Made in the USA labeling projects, which seems simple enough, but it's pretty complicated. You have to qualify to be authorized as a Made in the USA producer based on labor content, as well as overhead, as well as parts being sourced in the U.S. So you need to have roughly 95% of your product needs to be made in the U.S. in order to label it Made in the USA. And that's controlled by the Federal Trade Commission. So there's some fairly complicated laws regarding that. So we do a lot of that kind of work as well. So, you know, all kinds of consulting work to help companies evaluate and support American manufacturing.
Getting back to that American made is, it's very much kind of an intrinsic value so much as it is an initiative, right? And of course, we've seen it used as like a political ploy. We've seen it as kind of this call to action. But at the end of the day, it is an intrinsic value. And that's one of those things that I think makes the American economy very unique. But for a lot of companies, if you're just starting out a company, maybe you're just starting out to build a product or things like that, you have to go some places like China or like Bangladesh, India, to source things because it's cost prohibitive. And then getting back once you've started can then in itself be very expensive, right? So for companies who are looking to maybe start a reshoring initiative or start reshoring some efforts, what are those first things that they really need to think about before they start thinking about bringing back their manufacturing, their production back home?
Yeah, so we outlined a whole methodology for evaluating this, but you know, mostly you start with a total cost of ownership model to understand what your true costs are for overseas. And you know, TCO models are sort of commonplace. They're sort of a dime a dozen. You can download stuff, and you know, from the internet, that's pretty good as a starting point anyway. So you would start with evaluating your overall cost, and then we customize those to fit your business. So for example, an apparel business is different from a machine shop, right? So you have to customize these TCO models to fit your business requirements. So we would start there. Then, you know, we would take information from field service reps and from marketing to understand where are you going? How are the products being developed? How are they, what are the new things that customers are demanding? What are the new bells and whistles or that sort of thing? So we would include that. So you've got a total cost of ownership. You understand what the product is, where you're going with it, or if you're going to introduce a brand new product, and then surveying your market to make sure that if you introduce it, you can sell it. And then understanding what all the costs are. And that's a pretty big step too, where you try to engineer out as much of the cost as you possibly can. And you do that through automation and through streamlining processes in manufacturing in order to get the price of your product competitive. That's a big step. And then, you know, looking at distribution and logistics, where do you keep inventory or do you keep inventory? These are all component parts to that decision. It's complicated for sure. It's not as easy as saying, you know, I shipped everything to China and now I'm going to bring everything home. It's complicated. And also just an afterthought, leaving China is very difficult. And I think we might save that for a future episode all about how to leave China or if you should or can. But leaving China is difficult and reestablishing manufacturing in the U.S. is also difficult and should be rethought so that you're actually have an efficient operation here.
I'm going to jot that down in notes as save for a future episode, how to leave China, if it's a good decision for you or for not. Let's talk a little bit about the difference between reshoring and nearshoring. We talk a lot on our FreightWaves programs, especially FreightWaves Now, about nearshoring and how we've seen now explosive manufacturing come to Mexico. You mentioned central Mexico being that source of cheap labor. Just south of the border for us on the southern border in the United States has become a source of manufacturing specifically for electronics, electric vehicles, things like that. But reshoring and nearshoring aren't exactly the same thing. One gets you closer to home, one gets you actually to home. Is nearshoring a stepping stone for companies that are looking to reshore, or is it just a different beast all in itself?
You know, I think right now it's a completely different idea. But we help a lot of companies to nearshore as well. I mean, we'd rather get things as close to home as possible. Instead of these long global supply chains that are subject to all kinds of strife and so forth. So nearshoring, you know, is an interesting topic because it includes essentially for us, Mexico and sometimes Central America. Central America, Costa Rica, El Salvador, those places are also very good options if you have a lot of labor involved, a sewing shop, for example, or assembly of electronic parts. Those countries are good places because the labor rate is so cheap. So nearshoring is bringing it closer to home, probably to Mexico. That's where most of our clients want to go. And Canada is certainly another possibility, although from what I can see, there isn't much movement to Canada. But yeah, Central Mexico, as you mentioned, is particularly important. Along the border, while there's a ton of development going there and a lot of Chinese companies have purchased factories along the border. So there's lots of buzz and activity along the border, which is, you know, we can talk extensively about that in a later episode too. But Central Mexico is very cost competitive. And so we know from our study that Central Mexico is at the very low end of a global labor structure. So if you have a lot of labor into your product, do you want to look for a low-cost labor environment? Mexico has another advantage is that it's fairly industrialized, and there are a lot of industrial areas like Guadalajara that are, or Monterrey, that are industrial cities that are making auto parts and electronics and so forth. So there is industrialization as well that you wouldn't find so much if you went to Central America, for example. So, you know, that's an advantage. And then if you are manufacturing your product in Mexico and it is includes labor and overhead and cost structures and raw materials in Mexico, so it's country of origin Mexico and qualifies for USMCA, which is the new NAFTA, if you will, and that's the trade agreement between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, it can, your goods can enter into the U.S. duty-free. So we're dealing with a Chinese penalty tariffs of 25%, rising costs in China, and when you compare that to Central Mexico with Mexican labor and Mexican parts that come into the U.S. duty-free, you know, it's pretty good. The cost comparison is very favorable for Mexico, and you can just drive across the border. So you don't have to wait for 6 weeks to have your container unloaded in the Port of Long Beach or Los Angeles. You can just drive across the border. So that's pretty cool, too. So yeah, it makes Mexico and nearshoring very attractive idea, in addition to reshoring, of course, which is our favorite idea to bring manufacturing back to the U.S.
So we've got a couple of minutes left in our first episode of Rethink Reshoring, and I want to get your thoughts on some of those topics that you're most excited to explore. Personally, I really want to get into the distinction and kind of the switch up from globalization to regionalization to this kind of like nearshoring, much shorter, less complicated supply chains. But what are some of those things that you're really excited to talk about?
Yeah, I think, you know, most companies that I'm working with, the executives have some ideas on their agenda, their top agenda. And reshoring is one. I think that's a pretty hot topic, if you will, but also sustainability, so environmental concerns. So if you actually bring manufacturing back to the U.S., it hits both of those topics. By manufacturing close to your market, if you have a big market in the U.S., then manufacturing close to your market improves your sustainability and reduces your carbon footprint. If the closer you are to delivery, the better off you are. So that's good. And of course, supporting the U.S. economy and so that we get back to something that's more robust is also very good. So that's, you know, that's a really hot topic for me, is sustainability in conjunction with reshoring. So that's really important. And then I think, you know, another topic is this whole idea of leaving China. You know, as I said, I helped lots of companies go to China because that was the strategy in the early 2000s. That's what executives wanted to do. And now I think, you know, I honestly think that executives got a lot smarter and now are considering much more about the global environment than they ever have before. And so leaving China is the other thing that I would say is really important, and understanding how to do it and when to do it and what the benefits are of bringing some of that manufacturing back home.
Well, Rosemary, I think we have a lot to cover here in the upcoming weeks with Rethink Reshoring. Plenty of content that we will dig into, and our show will air Tuesday afternoons at 2:30 Eastern Time right here on FreightWaves TV. In the meantime, if people want to get in contact with you specifically at the Reshoring Institute, maybe they now have a little bit of a reshoring bug that they want to learn a little bit more about, where can they go to do that?
Yeah, so you can contact us at info@reshoringinstitute.org. We are a nonprofit organization. We're a 501c3 nonprofit and nonpartisan organization. And the best way to reach out is just that email. It's info@reassuringinstitute.org, and we'll respond to you as quickly as possible.
Awesome. We will be back next week for another episode of Rethink Reassuring. I'm Kaylee Nix. You can catch me every single morning here on FreightWaves TV. Thank you guys so much for staying tuned. We're excited to launch into this new journey, and we'll catch you guys next week.